and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of how the Trump administration's foreign policy looks like from abroad, 1 year after an American first isolationist whose business empire has been built upon shady financial deals with kleptocratic families and despotic regimes around the world, became president of the United States, defeating a former Secretary of State who got 3 million more votes than he did. Thomas Wright, a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center on the United States at the Brookings Institution, and the author of All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power, joins us. We'll discuss his article at the Irish Times, In the Age of Trump, Maybe It Gets Worse From Here, and the apparent retreat underway around the world of democratic institutions and the rule of law because of Trump's embrace of criminal regimes and powerful despots he appears to admire. We'll examine the consequences of the unprecedented commingling of the Trump family businesses with U.S. foreign policy, and whether, in spite of the crippling of the Department of State under Rex Tillerson, the generals surrounding Trump can prevent the ship of state from sinking America's standing and reputation around the world. Then, with the recent veto by the Russians that shut down a UN inquiry into the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons against his own people, as Assad and his Russian and Iranian backers head for a Pyrrhic victory in Syria, a country that has been torn apart and largely destroyed, we will speak with Faraz Fayed, an award-winning Syrian filmmaker, about his latest film, The Last Men in Aleppo, which won the World Cinema Grand Jury Prize for Documentary at the 2017 Sundance Film Festival. He joins us to discuss the work of the White Helmets, who are the subject of his film. They are ordinary Syrians who dig men, women, and children out from under the collapsed buildings, often with their bare hands, risking their lives as Russian bombs rain down on civilians, as their city, Aleppo, is gradually turned to rubble. And joining us now is Thomas Wright, a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. And he has an article at the Irish Times, In the Age of Trump, Maybe It Gets Worse From Here. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Wright.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining us from Ireland, Thomas. And you have an overseas perspective because of your current geographic situation. But my sense is, you know, covering the Trump administration, it feels like a sort of daily dose of doom. But in general, and this is very much in the spirit of your article, my sense is that if you look at the globe, it feels like the bad guys are winning and that democracy is in retreat, that the good guys are just either not standing up or they haven't emerged yet. Am I right to be that pessimistic?
Well, I think there are signs of a pushback. You know, what I tried to do in the article, it was really on the 1 year anniversary of the election, was to take a look back at this past 12 months and say, you know, have things sort of fallen apart? Where are we headed? And I think when you look at that, you see a couple of things going on. One is that, you know, Trump's election was very dramatic. He says lots of very controversial things. He's tried to do various things that are quite damaging to the international order. But at the same time, you know, there are many people in key positions that are quite reasonable and that have been pushing back against him. They've had some success. We haven't had a major international crisis so far. There are obviously serious problems with North Korea, but it hasn't become a full-blown short-term crisis yet. And so what I was really asking was, you know, does this mean that things will continue to get better? You know, there will always be these problems, but we'll see these mainstreamers, the so-called adults in the room, you know, pushing back, and then Putin and Xi Jinping will be in, will be checked somewhat. Or when we look back in this year in 4 or 5 years' time, will we say that this was the year where there was sort of a phony war, everyone was getting ready to do what they wanted, Trump was trying to figure out the levers of government, and in time he began to control his own administration more, and Xi Jinping and Putin acted more, and actually we are about to enter a period of deteriorating, you know, world politics. And I think there's a pretty good case that it could actually get worse, you know, that we shouldn't be complacent because of the influence of Mattis and others. That's not necessarily a stable situation.
Well, clearly Putin will be preoccupied running for president again, and he will run on the basis that the enemies are at the gate and the Americans are out to get us. And that is his entire mindset, going back to his KGB guys with Glavny Protivnik, the main enemy being the focus of all KGB officers, let alone one in East Germany. And, you know, Vladimir Putin clearly is obsessed with tearing America down, not building up Russia. In fact, he's looting Russia, him and his friends. But they do have a massive control of the media and the minds of the Russian people. And he's managed to hold on to this kleptocracy by using the outside enemy. And of course, having sanctions imposed on him only plays into that narrative. The only mirror, I would say, in terms of equating Trump and Putin, apart from whatever the special investigation of Robert Mueller discloses, is that already, to some extent, the Putin-type media has infected the United States. All of Trump's followers are in a bubble of Breitbart, Fox, Sinclair, believing in Trump and his lies, and believing that the truth that the mainstream media puts out is fake news. So I think you could make the case that not this entire country hasn't fallen under the spell of an authoritarian media scape, but at least half of the country appears to have.
Well, I mean, I do think that in the Republican Party, I think there are some people who are very aware of this threat and are pushing back against it. And, you know, I think what Putin is doing, though, that he basically understands that the openness of our system leaves us vulnerable to political warfare, to information warfare. And he's been waging that pretty aggressively for the last few years. And, you know, the Russians, Soviets before them, are old masters at this. They know how to do it. And he engaged in this in part because he believed the West was doing that to him in our own way. And he basically believes that the liberal international order is an existential threat to his regime, because over time it will compel Russia to liberalize and will spell the end of authoritarianism. And so he's pushed back. And I think what we're seeing now is this persistent and continuous sort of political warfare, political conflict between Russia and the United States. And at the moment, they have the upper hand on it, for sure. And what they've done, I think, cleverly is, you know, intervened in a way that the beneficiaries basically see Russian actions as serving their interests. They don't necessarily believe they're serving Russia's interests, which of course makes the Russian interference even more effective. And Trump's inability to sort of recognize that, and his belief that recognizing it would call into question his own legitimacy, means that the U.S. continues to be relatively defenseless, or certainly not as well equipped to defend against these attacks from Putin.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Wright, who's a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. And he has an article at the Irish Times, In the Age of Trump, Maybe It Gets Worse from Here. Well, the other extent to which it's gotten worse, apart from the sort of fake news media machine that seems to have created a bubble of people who support Trump who are immune to facts and evidence, and we clearly see that in what's happening in Alabama. The other depressing fact is that along with Putin and Xi Jinping, who don't give a damn about human rights and want to make deals around the world with every kleptocrat, dictator, thug, and criminal, and despot, Donald Trump is also more or less saying it's okay for the U.S. to abandon human rights. There he is having Duterte, the murderous leader in the Philippines, serenade him when he was recently in Asia, and then at the same time saying that the press are a bunch of spies. And of course, any prior president of the United States would have come to the defense of American values, but Donald Trump didn't.
Yes, it's really a striking, you know, departure, I think. You know, previous American presidents have, of course, befriended authoritarian regimes, and they've often been accused of being hypocritical about it, or, you know, they've compromised for the national interest sometimes. But we've never really seen before someone who, as a matter of principle, seems to cast aside human rights concerns and you know, endorse what somebody like Duterte says, or for that matter, Xi Jinping or Putin. You know, he praised Xi Jinping as a very strong leader with an incredible victory in China with the recent 19th Party Congress. Never mentioned, of course, that it was you know, an authoritarian system that lacked the legitimacy of a democratic systems. So this is a big departure. The question is, what does it really matter? And I think the big sort of problem of what he's doing is that when these guys feel like they have a blank check to do whatever they want, they will do whatever they want, right? When you shine a light and push for human rights, it won't necessarily be effective all of the time, but it makes it more difficult for authoritarians to engage in those human rights abuses. And we saw one of his earlier trips, he went to Poland, which is, of course, a democracy and a member of NATO, but there are problems about the erosion of democratic institutions. That would have been a perfect example for him to speak up for those and to tilt the balance of the debate in Poland toward protecting democratic institutions, and he didn't. He endorsed the government, talked about fake news and all of that, and sort of, which was seen as a criticism in Poland of the Polish media and the free press that's been under attack from the government. So this comes at a real cost, I think, and it will have a long-term impact in terms of the erosion of those norms.
Well, the other pillar of civilization, if you will, which I sense is under threat and in retreat, as I mentioned in the beginning, the feeling is that the bad guys are winning at the moment, is the rule of law, along with human rights, which Trump is ignoring and abandoning the decades-long U.S. moral stand on that regard. But the rule of law is, once you lose that, then you really have lost everything, my sense is. And if you look at the Paradise Papers that recently were revealed, there's a commingling of all the kleptocrats and crooks in the world and despots who hide their stolen treasure from the countries that they're looting. It's sort of commingled with the money from plutocrats and oligarchs around the world and here in the United States. And that's a sort of window, I think, in enabling a kind of illegality that's taking place. And if, well, let me ask you this. Could we reach a tipping point where regimes like Putin's, which is a kleptocracy, where, you know, the intelligence services are working hand in glove with criminal networks to steal money through cyberspace? China has also shown its contempt for rules, although after they stole all that OPM data from the Office of Personnel Management, they did apparently reach an agreement with the U.S. in secret to write the rules of the road. No such agreement exists with Putin, and it's not likely as long as he's going to be running on an anti-American platform to get reelected. So am I correct in having some qualms about the idea that we could reach a tipping point where criminal regimes will become the norm, if not reach a critical mass on the global stage?
Well, I think it's, you know, I'm pretty confident actually about the future of Western democracy and of you know, the US-led international order. And I think it's very possible to sort of push back against this. And I think if you were choosing, you know, a hand of cards that each side has, you would definitely choose the ones that the US has over other nations or other groupings.
But we have the best hand, we have the best cards, but the guy that's dealing them, Donald Trump, is not playing them.
Yeah, I know, I agree. But I think there are, you know, the system is at the moment stronger than the individual. And if you look at the Asia trip as an example, there were certain positive things that happened on that trip substantively. They were you know, balanced out by some of the more erratic and foolish things that Trump did. But the system, the bureaucratic system, did sort of grind forward and make some progress. But what I was going to say was that while, you know, I think it's possible to push back, but I do think we're at a tipping point in terms of this being the defining struggle. You know, I think that the outcome is not assured, and I don't think we're on the cusp of losing it or collapse or anything like that. But I think this is emerging as a defining sort of foreign policy challenge, a national challenge of the next decade or two decades. It won't be terrorism. It won't be, you know, won't be intervention, humanitarianism as it was in the 90s. Those things will all play a role. But I think the defining one is a dividing line is this clash of visions of international order between sort of that U.S., you know, Western vision and then sort of a more Putin-esque and Xi Jinping-esque vision, which are very much at odds. And in Putin's case, I think it is more anarchical, definitely, than what we've grown used to.
And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back continuing the conversation with Thomas Wright, who joins us from Ireland.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. War is not the answer. Politician and them, Bobo Nyan, yeah. War is not the answer. I simply know what the solution Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer. Tell the politician and them start drop them bomb, yeah. War is not the answer. I simply know what the solution Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer.
Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Thomas Wright, who's a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. And he has an article at the Irish Times in the Age of Trump, Maybe It Gets Worse From Here. So if we can't do anything about Xi Jinping, who is obviously trying to become a major player, if not a dominant player on the world stage, and Vladimir Putin, who, as you pointed out, has already perfected a kind of hybrid warfare, which he's declared in terms of the use of cyber and measures short of kinetic warfare, and he's been very successful at, and he's not going to change his ways. The only possibility would be to remove Donald Trump. And already the Senate Foreign Relations Committee held a hearing on Trump's suitability to be a steward of the nuclear arsenal. Corker, of course, their chair being a Republican who feels that Donald Trump has neither stability or the competence to have access to the nuclear weapon. And then, of course, a number of Democratic Congress people have put forth articles of impeachment. Is that a chimera on the part of the Democrats, or is there any kind of possibility that we could cut short Trump's tenure?
I think the only circumstance, I mean, you know, the part of it is just simple math, right? You need 2/3 of majority in the Senate to remove a president from power. And that won't be there without Republican support. So Democrats can't remove Trump on their own. I think that it's unlikely in the short term that any of that is going to change. But I think the one circumstance under which it could happen is if there was a major either national or international crisis that Trump, you know, completely failed to address, way beyond anything we've seen already. So if he initiated a conflict in North Korea and it completely backfired and was calamitous, or there was a major financial crisis that was handled extraordinarily badly, any of those things, obviously, those would be catastrophic. So we have to hope that they very much don't happen and work to prevent them from occurring. But I think that would be the only circumstance, I think, under which he would be impeached and removed. It would require a real shift in the political context, which of course could occur, but we hope it won't. Aside from that, I think the base case has to be that he will be there for 4 years. And, you know, unless his vote completely collapses and goes, say, lower than 30%, he will constantly tell himself that he had bad numbers before and they're not true, and he won't win re-election because he won election. And, you know, he won't, I think, really take a lot of these numbers at face value. And so I don't think he's going to resign. To me, the big question, though, Ian, is the one I sort of raised in the article. It's, you know, he's been boxed in to some extent over the last 8 or 9 months by Kelly and Mattis and McMaster and others. Not all the time, but a lot of the time he's been boxed in. Do they continue to exert control, or does Trump find a way to break out to get people who will sort of implement some of his more radical beliefs or views, who will empower him rather than trying to contain or constrain him? Will he be able to pull that off? Does he want to pull that off? I think that's the big question to me. And unfortunately, I think that the power of the office is such that the person who holds it, the person who is the president, always has the ability to do that if they can find the people. He hasn't had anyone yet, because they were totally unprepared to govern. But the longer he's in there, I think the more some of those people will emerge. And he, I think, will replace some of the mainstream people with some of those people. And, you know, people like Tom Cotton, I think, have been auditioning for that role. There's probably more junior people in the administration who will gain experience, who will be eligible to go into more senior roles. So I worry about that. I think that is maybe the way this is going to evolve.
Well, that is a kind of nightmare combination of Game of Thrones and House of Cards, in the sense that Pompeo, the rank and file of the CIA, were alarmed that he met with a bizarre conspiracy theorist who believes that U.S. intelligence was behind the DNC hack, not the Russians. And that's created a lot of disquiet. And apparently Pompeo wants to be the Secretary of State, and clearly Tillerson's in trouble or has lost the confidence of Trump. So Cotton could replace Pompeo at CIA, which would be catastrophic. And I can't imagine that the workforce would be very happy about that. And State Department is in pretty bad shape already under Tillerson, given that Pompeo is such a partisan. He's obviously a West Point graduate and a smart man. But on the other hand, he's shown with the Benghazi hearings when he was in the House to be very partisan. So I take it to your point that it could get worse. But my sense is that maybe we're being driven not just by the reckless amateurism of a president, but there's also an element of avarice going on here and personal enrichment that the House Democrats brought up in their call for impeachment. I mean, for example, Jared Kushner has been meeting with MBS, the young crown prince in Saudi Arabia, who's very impetuous and has gotten Saudi Arabia into a war in Yemen with no end in sight. And apparently Jared has been shaking down the Qataris for money for the building on 666 Fifth Avenue that's underwater. And they blockaded Qatar without apparently consulting Tillerson, who was caught by surprise. And clearly it's a bad idea and going nowhere. And Mattis apparently was appalled because the biggest U.S. base is there in Qatar. So you have these examples of, you know, the family having all of this power via the father, and cabinet members being humiliated on the world stage. Is there any way that that can be contained? You mentioned the adults in the room, but more often than not, the adults are being blindsided.
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten a little bit better with Kelly. I mean, he has reduced the avenues that Kushner has to run sort of an independent operation outside of Kelly as the chief of staff's control. But I think the problem is still very much there. I don't know if, obviously, none of us know if there are private business interests at stake. I'm assuming, you know, that there are not, although, you know, obviously that would be a major concern. But what worries me about the Kushner MBS stuff, or Kushner generally in the Middle East or really anywhere, is that I don't think he really knows what he's dealing with. And so They know that they want to be close to the Saudis, which I think a Clinton administration would have done too, for better or worse. But they've basically given Mohammed bin Salman a blank check and told him that they will endorse anything he does. And MBS, because of his hawkishness and his age and his hubris and the fact that he's never really encountered major setbacks in his life so far, you know, he's a prime candidate to sort of overreach and to get himself into trouble. And I would think the role of a smart superpower ally would be to, you know, constrain him a little bit and make it clear where the red lines are and shape his behavior and make it, and, you know, and say that there are limits, privately express that there are limits to what the U.S. would support. And they haven't done that. And so we've seen the results. You know, we've seen a Cold War with Qatar. We've seen an intensification of the Yemen operation when last year MBS was talking about reducing that. We've seen these latest incidences in Saudi Arabia, including against staunch allies of the U.S. and within the royal family. All of these things, I think, are cause for alarm, and they seem to trace back from Kushner's approach to MBS. So I think they're playing with fire, things are beginning to, you know, the China's beginning to like bump up against the walls a little bit, and something's going to break pretty soon, right? But it hasn't fully broken yet. They need, I think, to sort of reassert America's diplomatic influence and try to keep a lid on this situation, because that's generally been the traditional role of America, has been trying to keep a lid on problems, and they've just blown the lid right off.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Wright, who's a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. And he has an article at the Irish Times in The Age of Trump, Maybe It Gets Worse From Here. And of course, the father-in-law, Donald Trump, has gone along with everything that Kushner has done with his new best friend, MBS. And by extension, MBS apparently is his mentor, is MBZ, the head of Abu Dhabi, who apparently is quite aggressive and plotting. And my fear is that you already have in the Emirates the mercenary army of Eric Prince, who is close to Steve Bannon. And it wouldn't take a lot to spark an incident with the Iranian IRGC and their speedboats in the Gulf, particularly in the Straits of Hormuz, which are very narrow, and sink a couple of ships, and then you have a major international calamity on your hands. I mean, how much could the tail wag the dog here in terms of the impetuousness of MBZ? He would like, I think, the Americans to take on the Iranians. I think Netanyahu would like the Americans to take on the Iranians. We've got a lot of military hardware in the Gulf. Does it worry you that it wouldn't take much to spark an incident with the already, you know, paranoid IRGC?
I think it could, but I worry a little less about outright war with Iran, and because I think there are sort of there were elements that constrain both sides. I do think it's a worry, and I think, you know, I think there are a lot of Americans who would agree that the U.S. ought to push back more against Iran than Obama did. I think Clinton believed that. But again, there's a problem with giving MBZ and MBS a blank check to do this, because I think they want to push, particularly Mohammed bin Zayed wants to push the envelope as far as possible. But what I was going to say was that what has happened, though, already, are things that no one really anticipated, which was the, you know, the Saudi Qatar spat escalating massively. You know, the situation in Lebanon over the last week, the way that's evolved, with the change in government there, prime minister there, that was largely unexpected as well. The manner in which that happened, the purge in Saudi Arabia. So a lot of these are taking place. You know, they're connected to Iran a little bit. There's an element of Iranian dimension to these issues. But these are things that are happening that I think are partly because of the uncertainty created by Trump and the licenses he's given to others. And, you know, this could evolve in unexpected and very destabilizing ways.
Well, you mentioned earlier, Thomas Wright, that North Korea could be an incident that could either make or break the Trump administration. And now you've made a case that maybe the Iran, I mean, the one part of that scary picture that you have painted is that a missile landed on the main airport in Riyadh recently, fired from Yemen with Iranian fingerprints on it. So maybe that was their way of just reminding MBS that they're in real power. But I'm not sure an impetuous, spoiled kid like that, along with his American counterpart, are necessarily going to take that lesson soberly.
Right. And I think the other thing that they don't fully realize is that they can't trust that Trump will have their back. You know, they think they have the super hawkish American government that will always be by their side. But he could easily sell them out. You know, he could blow up the Iran deal and not actually, you know, take action against the Iranian nuclear program. He could, you know, he could sell out the South Koreans and do a deal with Kim Jong-un. You know, he could do a deal with China and sell out the Japanese. So there are lots of hawks around the world who think, oh, you know, this is a welcome antidote to Obama because Trump is more willing to be tough. But I actually worry as much about his weakness, and I worry about his indecision, and I worry about the fact that he doesn't really care about allies, because he doesn't really understand why the U.S. is engaged in these parts of the world. And ultimately, he's a prime candidate to be a sucker in a two-way bargain with an adversary. And I don't think they fully appreciate that. They don't, you know, a discussion with Jared Kushner does not a solid alliance make.
Well, Thomas Wright, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate the conversation.
Great. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
And again, I'll be speaking with Thomas Wright, who's a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. And he has an article at the Irish Times in The Age of Trump, Maybe It Gets Worse From Here. And he joined us from Ireland. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a very brave Syrian filmmaker who stayed in Aleppo all the way through the siege and the final fall, documenting the White Helmets who rescued people from out under the rubble. The interview took place a few days ago before the Russians vetoed a UN panel that was doing an inquiry into the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons against its own people. But clearly the bad guys have won in Syria. Let's now go to a station break, and we'll be back speaking with Firaz Fayed. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is Firaz Fayed, who is an award-winning Syrian filmmaker, and he's directed and edited both documentary and fiction films. He has participated in international film festivals and received recognition for his work about contemporary Syrian issues and the political transformation in the Arab world. His latest film, The Last Men in Aleppo, won the World Cinema Grand Jury Prize for Documentary at the 2017 Sundance Film Festival. Welcome to Background Briefing, Firaz Fayed.
Thank you so much.
And it does feel like a terrible time in the world. where the bad guys are winning. It feels like it here in the United States. We have a terrible president. Every day you read the newspaper and more terrible things are happening, much of which will have devastating effects for decades to come. But Syria is really, I think, the most glaring example of the really bad people winning. How does it feel to you as a Syrian at this moment?
Well, actually, this is one of the questions in how I can tell through this is film, this is a story, and this is a question, and following the through that. And it was like when you see, like when I was following the white helmets for them, they are the first responded on the heavy bomb from the Russians and the Syrian regime allies. It show you how much we have enough evidence for the crime that's happened there, and it show you like who's like behind this is the war crimes that accused in the death more than 100,000 people in Syria and accused in the big refugee crisis that was which is developed after the Russian start to bomb in Syria. Through that, my character, I show like how much this is people is in a position that they have more responsibility than they can handle it, and they are left alone. And they try like to promote in the media they are a hero and they can take care about their countries, which is like this is, it's not easy for the people. They don't have anything. They're just their hands and mock them like in a position fighting one of the powerless country like Russians that they use everything to destroy them. And then after that, this is people, they start to collect this is evidence of the, on the Russians that start like the Russians more like use all this is kind of propaganda against them. So the feeling it's now it's could like you feel like you left alone. You saw everything in front of you destroyed, and you have all this is should the support, and you should have all this is support because you doing this is people doing something for support the peace and staying in the country, not accusing in not leaving the country, and there was a hope for the people to stay, not accusing the people like to leave. And this is a kind of the feeling. It's very, very destructions for anyone's who forced to leave Syria, which is this is the right things, or who's decide to stay, and killed and on the hand the Russian and the wrong policy in Syria.
Right. Well, it does seem though from the very beginning of the Syrian revolution, which was spontaneous and it followed the fall of Gaddafi in Libya, and it was the time of the Arab Spring, that since the people rose up and then Assad was shooting them down in the streets, nobody really came to the defense of the Syrian people. And we're talking about 80% majority,
yes, you know,
of the country. And it's been the, 6-year tragedy since then. And it seems that at this point, what's going to happen to the 80%, the majority? A lot have gone to Europe, I understand. Millions are in camps. Do you, as a Syrian, are you accepting defeat, which is what it feels like?
Well, the people in Syria, they will, as they fight, and there was as believe that in the freedom of speech and freedom and democracy and that they start like to go to the street in the non-violence ways. Mm. They lived alone for almost 2 years without any help before turning to be civil wars because the using the Syrian regime's the force and the power against them and shot them in the street and by the planes. Normally, all this is people. How much they lose, how much they have feeling of they will not accept it. Mm. The Assad anymore. And because we speaking about destruction country, divided. There is no hope for to be, there is a Syria will be again. Mm-hmm. And Syria is a pieces. between different hands, and a society completely lose all the kind of being together. And every family almost lose one or two members from that. And how all of these people, even who support Assad, they know he's responsible about that, because they start to feel that the Russian is in their street, the Iranian in their street. They control their street, and that's in front of the eyes all the international community, and there is no any react about that, and using chemical weapons once, and the second, and falling of Aleppo, and then falling of Homs, and falling of Aleppo, and then now siege of Al-Ghouta, and using the hunger against the civilians, where like they are 250,000 people sieged, and there is urgent situation, like the cancers, and there is no medicine for them.
Right. That's well, in the film, yeah. The father takes his daughter to the doctors, and
exactly.
They explain that she's got malnutrition, and he feels wretched that he can't do anything.
Yes.
You know, that's got to be the hardest thing in the world, to see your children starving. Yeah.
And that show you this is people who's in through last minute Aleppo. We try to show this is people what they looking for. They looking for the simple things, simple need. They didn't like look to this is like as Assad our Russian promoting like they are working for the CIA or working for that like to make the society against them. This like these people was seeking for just like for medicine for their children and want to see even everything around them destroyed. But they didn't give up. Right. Even now, even if Aleppo fall down, if you go like to every Syrian, including me, including my family who is still in Syria, including me, what do you think about that? Are you accepting Assad again? I will say it now more stronger in the idea I will not accept it, Assad, because he will absolutely, he's not the right person, because he will get the right. occupation, the Russian occupation for Syria, and there is no Assad. There is Putin, and there is Iranian policy in Syria.
Right. And again, Firas Fayyadis joining us in the studio. He's an award-winning Syrian filmmaker. He's directed and edited both documentary films and fiction films. He's participated in international film festivals and received recognition for his work about contemporary Syrian issues and the political transformation in the Arab world. And his latest film is The Last Men in Aleppo, which won the World Cinema Grand Jury Prize for Documentary at the 2017 Sundance Film Festival. And the film will be coming out when? When can our audience see your film?
Now the audience can see the films on Netflix.
On Netflix.
Yeah.
And right now?
Yes, right now.
Excellent. Yeah. Now, Aleppo, of course, the film, most of the city's been destroyed, and you watch the rest of it being destroyed by Russian bombers, and it's just a wasteland. Mm-hmm. But it was an extraordinary city. It had a World Heritage Site, was the souk, the extraordinary. And that was destroyed pretty early on, was it, in the Civil War?
Yeah. Yes. Well, Aleppo, as the heritage recording, the international heritage recording, that Aleppo, one of the oldest, 10 oldest cities in the world, as a city. We're speaking about the cities, like completely with all the elements of that you can call the city as a city. And you can see it when everyone who visit Aleppo, he can find his history there. Mm-hmm. And there's a different books that said like Aleppo and Damascus is not just two Syrian cities. It's like history for everyone on the earth.
It's a crossroads between the east and the west.
Yes. Completely. Damascus is all this capital as a capitals and Aleppo as a city. And with all this is kind of the heritage that you see it, I try like to transfer it in the films through like use the element of Aleppo as a story, but as an element in the films, as a theme in the story, the relation between the characters and their cities. Mm-hmm. And but also use it like how is the enemy, it's like the Russians like try like to destroy this is city with all this is history, with all this is like the people who was decide to stay. And through many scenes, you can see like people going like to street to buy fish because they. And this is one of the scene that the main character go like when the city sieged and completely like will fall down, close to fall down and destroyed, and he decide go to buy fish, and then he find the fish sellers in the street. And then to build like a small aquarium in his space, that show you like this is people, they have a long plan to not leave their city. Right. And when Aleppo fall down, it just like those is people forest with all kind of the power and without any help, without any support. And this is kind of the shame that all the humanity, it's like it's part from our shame in history. Mm-hmm. And all of this is people, where they end? When we asking about the refugee crisis, who accused in the refugee crisis? It's a Syrian accused. This is people who was like forced to leave their country, accused in the refugee crisis. No, I mean, there is a big powers behind pushing the people and for them and don't care about the international laws, don't care about any kind of all the human rights.
And again, Firas Fayyadis joining us in the studio. He's an award-winning Syrian filmmaker. He's directed and edited both documentary films and fiction films. He's participated in international film festivals and received recognition for his work about contemporary Syrian issues and the political transformation in the Arab world. And his latest film is The Last Men in Aleppo, which won the World Cinema Grand Jury Prize for Documentary at the 2017 Sundance Film Festival. Well, you know, unfortunately, our president has changed American foreign policy. There was always, at least since Jimmy Carter's presidency, an emphasis on human rights and a moral dimension to U.S. foreign policy. And it's changed completely under Donald Trump. But, of course, the cynical part of the Russian situation is that the Russians are also have a seat on the Security Council of the United Nations and have always vetoed any efforts to address the humanitarian situation and also the human rights situation in Syria. It could actually, it's almost like we may be seeing a new war breaking out, as everybody seems to accept the idea that the Assad and the Russians and the Kurds and the Hezbollah and the Iranians have won. But now it seems as though something's going to happen either in Lebanon or with Hezbollah and the Israelis or even with Syria. It seems as though the Sunni Arab world is waking up to what the Jordanian king said some time back, warned about what he called the Shia Crescent, where there's going to be a land corridor from Tehran to Damascus and Tehran to Beirut. And I think the recognition that that's looking like a possibility has possibly reignited it. I mean, there's been a long proxy war, if you will, between the Saudis and the Iranians, and Syria, to some extent, is collateral damage. But do you foresee another round? It seems like something's going on with the Hariri going to Saudi Arabia, and a lot of rumors about a new war breaking out. And so just as this one ends, a new one begins. What's your opinion on that?
Well, of course, I mean, after falling of Aleppo, the thing's not going like to see, like, you will not see like there is like any solution that will coming over, like, because there is no winning in when Aleppo fall, because there is like a lot of money should be like put into rebuilding like a city like Aleppo, or rebuilding city like Homs, or rebuilding city like Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor. And this is, the Russian will not involve themselves like with that, because they don't have the abilities and to do these things alone. Then the Assad will find this other solution, how he can involve the European and involve the American in rebuilding to get their support from them. But some European country like draw a line that will say it will not involve in these things, and that's bring other levels with the conflict with the change in Saudi Arabia and the Iranian rules in Syria when they will start to move to Deir ez-Zor as a city, to control the Deir ez-Zor as a city, and then start something to be changed in Lebanon because they start to play a big role and use the Saad al-Hariri and his party, which is like for that's mean like it's control all the kind of the party, because the one of this big party like against Hezbollah was like Saad al-Hariri in the last one of this who is draw lines like next to the next to John Blatt. They was very clear about this is the policy of Hezbollah. And it's very clear and expected that will happen in Lebanon, because the role of Hezbollah that played and the Iranian role in Lebanon, it's drove all of this is kind of it's will get more like problems and conflict to the to the city, and then its influence from the role that played by Hezbollah and Iranian inside Syria.
Right. Well, but what's going to happen with, you mentioned reconstruction, and clearly the Russians don't have the money and they don't care, I don't think. They just want their bases and they want access to the Mediterranean for their navy. The Iranians don't have the money. Hezbollah is in trouble financially. The war has cost them a lot, and they're not being able to fulfill their social services. So will it mean that the West has to reconstruct Syria?
Well, from different meeting through screening last Minalibo in different parliament in Europe, there was very clear speaking about the future of Syria. The European, they blocked that. They said we're not involved in this. We'll not support that.
But can they make an insistence that in order to rebuild Syria, Assad has to go?
Yes, I think this is one of the conditions of they were rebuilding Syria, but this is will influence also about the role of Russia. Leaving Assad, if leave Syria, that's not the things now. But also, what's the question about the role of Iran in Syria and the role of Russia? This is the things there. Now, we have a two big problem that you find it in the biggest city, in Homs and Aleppo. This is forces of the Russians and in Hama and Latakia. This is like the base of the Russians theirs that they moved. They will not move it in easy way.
No.
Assad stay or leave, it's not now. It's just the problems. Now, what the Russian rules in this area and how they will use this money could the European or they will use it like to rebuild Syria. And this is the big deal, and this should be one of the thought in the policy of rebuilding Syria and reconstruct Syria. Otherwise then Assad goes and then other doll will coming and then will moved by Russians behind or the Iranian behind. And this is the conflict about who the next government. And that's make that the peace, like the negotiation of Geneva be not easy. And then they move negotiation, and they open other negotiation in Saudi Arabia and Egypt. So this is will not end in any ways, because there's a ways that they want somebody like accepted Russians and Iranian to be in the government if they agree about removing Assad.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, for our American audience, the film is very important in the sense that we have basically been silent and complicit in our silence as we've watched a country get destroyed by one family, a mafia family, that the people rose up spontaneously. They wanted freedom and they wanted democracy, and they were sick of this family dictatorship, and they were slaughtered, and it led to a civil war, and now the bad guys have won and the country's been destroyed. And what are you hoping for the American people to learn from your film?
First of all, knowing that the problem in Syria is not just about the country behind the Mediterranean and it's just about Syria. Syria, it's mean also in U.S. It's linked completely with the U.S. because this is the world. It's connected with each other, because the play of Russians is big, and the role of Russian will be their peaks, and then it will influence in U.S. because this is in general about, we're talking about the global problem in general. We're not just talking about we're talking about the petrols, gas, waters, a very geographic place, like it's close from everywhere, and influence country, and refugee crisis. We're talking about the global problems. This is what I want to the American audience know, that to care and understand Syria, it's not just because Syria about a just a refugee crisis, and if we solve there, then the refugee crisis will end. It's about understand the role of the other, the policy of the Russians and Iranian there, and what they want from Syria and how they will use it now or the future. It's the Mediterranean Sea. It's open in Europe, and Europe open in U.S. And that's easy, like, to all the time send to open. This is, like, how you control and how you can make build allies around you, the Turkish, right, with everyone's, and then how you can support your policy. They support, like, their how they can catch this country and use it in to attack the Americans. It will not end in this way. The policy of Russian is how they can more divide the American society. This is the things. It's not just about the Syrian. It's not just about their country or their nations. Right. Of course, this is in the human side. Of course, this is important. But in the deep side, also about the power conflict and about the economic side and the strategic place for the basic where the weapons and all of this is places. Yeah.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. Yeah, I appreciate it. I thank you for your very important film. And again, I've been speaking with Firas Fayyad, who's an award-winning Syrian filmmaker. He's directed and edited both documentary and feature films. He has participated in international film festivals and received recognition for his work about contemporary Syrian issues and the political transformation of the Arab world. And his latest film, The Last Men in Aleppo, won the World Cinema Grand Jury Prize for Documentary at the 2017 Sundance Film Festival, and it is available now at Netflix.
Thank you so much.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.